Greetings, everyone. This is Eric Andelin, Senior Workflow Specialist with SimActive, and you're listening to podcast number 6, How to Use Photogrammetry to Calibrate Sensors. And with me, I have my guest, Ken Scruggs with Midwest Aerial Photography. Ken, say hi to everybody.
Hello, everyone. Ken Scruggs. I'm founder and owner and president of Midwest Aerial Photography.
The man who does it all.
Based in Ohio.
The man who does it all.
Yeah, and take out the trash occasionally.
Right. So give me a little bit of detail or some information on how you got involved in aerial photography, mapping, all of that.
Well, actually, it was a combination of circumstances and events throughout my earlier life. I went to Miami University of Ohio and their engineering program. And while I was going to school there, I picked up photography as a hobby, but it was strictly a hobby, had nothing to do with anything else. So after school, I went to work for an engineering firm in Columbus, Ohio. And in that position, I got exposed to survey crews, was out on survey the field quite a bit. But it just so happened that this firm had a small mapping division, and this was long ago enough that most everything was photographic based, and that's where my interest was, that's where my passion was. So I switched from engineering to the photogrammetry section, and I worked for them for another 10 years. Then at that time, I kind of got ambitious and thought I could do a better job and do things better. So I put what little money I had where my big mouth was, and now I'm in business. That's the easy part. The hard part was I proceeded to starve for the next 5 years and really thought how long and hard and contemplated, did I make the right decision? And the alternative was not good, and I just chose to stick with it, and here we are. And that was 32 years ago. Yeah. So it's been a long, interesting process. I can say that I haven't been bored in 30 years. For sure.
Yeah. Well, I tell people all the time in these webinars that, you know, I came from that same background. My dad started aerial photography in, I think, 1980, and he did kind of the similar thing. He worked for an engineering company. He actually worked for Fugro, and Fugro had a mapping department at the time in Los Angeles, and he was dealing with the local aerial photographer that they were subcontracting work out to all the time. That gentleman wanted to get out of the business, so my dad decided he was going to jump in and purchase his company. Starve, as you said, for a few years. Fortunately, he had a military retirement that he could use to help out, but it sounds like the path is very similar.
Yeah, I think most of us in this industry, we all started out as technicians.
Yeah.
And then made a transition, hopefully successfully, from a technician to a business owner with an owner mindset. And sadly, some people don't make that transition successfully, and they're not with us today, you know, as a business anyway. So it's a completely different mindset, and it's not the easiest thing in the world, for sure, for a technician.
Well, and it's funny because you and I are both MAPS members, and we see that even today. We've got young MAPS members who, you know, might only have a plane. They don't even have a camera yet, and they're still interested in getting involved in the aerial photography and the LiDAR side of things. And, you know, it's still certainly a very viable business if you've got a good business plan, you know what you're doing. I'll put up a slide here, but what I wanted to bring up was what we would be talking about. And we're going to have a discussion in general about things, but some of the things that we want to cover so that people can follow along in the webinar, we're going to talk a little bit about aerial mapping in general, choosing the right sensor for what you're doing, collecting optimal data for calibration, because these sensors do need to be calibrated, performing calibrations, and then actually monitoring your cameras over time, because they do need to be constantly monitored to make sure that you're getting the optimal results to provide the best mapping that you can. Just in general, on the aerial mapping side, You started out with one plane, I assume, in a camera.
Started out with a Cessna 206 and an RC8 film camera.
Okay. Wow. RC8s. That's way back there. I should.
Well, the good thing about an RC8, you could actually go to a hardware store and buy parts and repair it.
I mean, I started in the back of a plane with an RC10, so I'm definitely familiar with the mechanical side of cameras, that's for sure. So from there, you worked with RC8s. I probably a 20 and a 30 at some point. What was the intent? So you were in Ohio. How did you grow the business?
In those starving years, I realized that there are a lot of people that could do a lot of things, and for some strange reason, they were doing it cheaper than I could, and I was the low overhead dealer. I didn't have an office, I didn't have a staff, I didn't have all these base expenses. So I realized pretty early I had to figure out how to do things that everybody else was not willing to do or were unable to do. And part of that was simply make my backyard, a lot bigger than it was. So over time, I was buying another airplane, then buy another camera system, and now I'm actually into, like the third generation of cameras, with all the digital stuff that we're doing. So sadly, you spend so much time and effort and money to buy these things, and sadly, in a few years, they're big doorstops, and that's just simply the nature of the beast, in this industry. You got to get as much as you can as fast as you can, because it's just going to be a point where it just has no viable use in the marketplace, and that's always a tough cookie to work with on that. But over the years, I'm up to 10 aircraft now. We're spread across the United States from California to DC to Florida, in addition to headquarters in Ohio, with multiple camera systems. We have five digital large format systems, two Optec LiDAR systems with co-mounted with phase one cameras. And we've worked with smaller format cameras. I've used Nikon D800s just for some testing, purposes. But typically, if you have the larger formats, you're not going to be using the smaller formats. We reach a point where we have a big toolbox, and you just look at the job, and with your experience, you turn around, go to that toolbox, and you pull out the right tool that's most appropriate for that project. And it might be large format, might be medium format, might be LiDAR, might be a combination of multiple of your tools to get the right end product.
Right, absolutely. And I remind our viewers and listeners that I'm going to spill the beans here a little bit, but SimActiv is going to have its 20th anniversary next year. So we've been around for quite a while, and we started in that large format world. And even though that's where we came from, I would say a lot of our business right now is in the medium format world with the phase one cameras. And we do drop down to the level of drones. But a part of the discussion I always have with people is, the amount of time it takes to process an image doesn't change whether it's a small format image or a large format image. The actual processing time is the same. So if you're flying something and you've got an option to do it in large format where it's going to take you six exposures versus 600 from a drone, you're way better off subcontracting that work to somebody who's got a large format aircraft to get that work done if you're talking about doing things quickly. So, like you said, it's your tool in the toolbox, and some people have small toolboxes, some people have really big toolboxes. And as that toolbox grows, you have to be savvy enough to know which is the right tool for the project that somebody's trying to accomplish. So you mentioned also that you have a couple LiDAR systems.
Correct. Yeah, we have the Optech Galaxy Prime systems, and both of we have two of them, and both are mounted with phase one camera systems. So some people have a preference of wanting large format and LiDAR. Some are okay with the phase one imagery, and I think that really just depends on the work their internal workflows on that. Since we are a essentially a data supplier, to the industry, we give them what they want. It just doesn't matter. Pricing is separate. We like to feel that we are a an augmentation to companies of all sizes. So our equipment is top of the line. We have enough of it, enough aircraft, enough staffing that we can partner with a much smaller firm. Maybe they're only a year, 2 years old. Maybe they just simply don't even want to have airplanes, but we can partner with them and suddenly they can compete, with anybody in the United States because we have all the right equipment, for that.
Right. Let's talk a little bit, and I mean, we're kind of going down that road anyway, but about choosing that right sensor for, a project. As you said, you guys are kind of a data supplier. So maybe it's more often that your customer dictates which camera system they may want or which LiDAR system, or do you find yourselves educating the end user on what might be the best tool for the project?
We find ourselves educating. Back when I got my first digital large format camera, I thought, okay, we're it. Here we are, we're ready to go. And so I went out and started talking to people. It's like, is that large format or is that medium format? Suddenly the questions were like, oh, they don't know. I need to help them along in integrating the digital camera systems into their workflows. And it's never stopped. It continues, to be that way because we do this every day. A lot of our customers don't do it every day.
Right.
So we're always in a matter of more of a conversation. It's not really a classroom setting. It's like, well, what do you need? And we're asked, what do we think? What would be the best system? Sometimes the economics determine that. If it's just a small project, maybe a mile in length over a section of highway, that might be several hundred miles away from where we're going to be with our aircraft. Well, okay, a drone can do that. Much more economical. We can't get our airplane there for the kind of budget that kind of project will have. So every tool is going to have its place.
That's definitely true. And it's funny because the webinar we did prior to this, I did with Pat McConnell, and we were talking, even for him, at the time he was selling cameras when they switched to digital. And he said he spent a lot of time just educating the customer on the difference between, say, map scale and GSD, and going from film to digital cameras and pixels was a big challenge for a lot of people to understand.
That's exactly right. Because the film, especially like the 6-inch 9x9 film camera systems, were such a standard literally for decades. And many people spent their whole life, in that. And going into a digital was a whole new ball game. And what part of the problem was every digital camera was different, had different number of pixels, different focal length. And this was something that was unusual and uncomfortable for a lot of people.
So, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I assume that's why, and I think I even said it in the last webinar, that that's kind of why calibration disappeared, at least in the States via USGS, because the number of sensors that were coming in were no longer film cameras and 9x9. It was a different digital camera from a different manufacturer all the time, and they had honestly probably didn't have the skill set or the equipment to calibrate those cameras.
Well, yeah, that's right. That's right. And they get to be got to be voluminous. The calibration lab at USGS in Reston, Virginia, it was just two guys. And they could do two or three camera systems a week. It was, that was their workflow. Now you start throwing in literally hundreds of different systems, and it would simply overwhelm them. They just simply weren't prepared for it. Plus, their everything was geared for the 9x9, film system.
And now, like you said, we've now moved to even to the medium formats, which are for example, phase one is pretty much a metric camera. It's designed to withstand atmospheric conditions and things like that, but yet it still has to be calibrated. So let's talk a little bit about, a little bit more about calibration. And you mentioned that, back in the day, at least here in the States, it was two guys that were doing the calibrations. And I can remember the agony that anybody felt back then when they had to ship their camera out to Reston and they may not see it for 3 months while they're waiting for a calibration. And then, fingers crossed, they get a good calibration because back in the day, most of the contracts out there required a certain quality or AWAR, to do that type of work. And if it came back, and again, this is a human thing. If it came back with a lesser calibration, maybe just because that day it didn't happen to work out for that person doing the calibration, that you were in a world of hurt. So, maybe that's a good thing about, the way calibrations change now. It is more scientific, I guess, maybe. I don't know.
Well, I think we're in a different ball game on that. So one of the first things that always, struck me wrong with some of the terminology, to me, a calibration was when you take something, you tweak it, and you make it fit. What they're really doing was validating and measuring the performance. They weren't changing anything. They weren't adjusting anything. And so you just had to, hope that the structural integrity of the interior of the camera system was good. Sometimes it would change a little bit and not. But the other thing that was happening, you never hear anybody talk about AWAR, which is average weighted area resolution. And I think that's mostly because in our age now, the lenses are designed by computers or computer-aided design, and we have clear imagery or high resolution from the center of the image all the way out to the corners. That wasn't the case years ago. So, and then what we're really doing now, we're doing a an in situ calibration, or I want to really use the word validation, where you're testing the whole system in the environment in which it's going to be used. So, in the old days, with the film cameras, you send it into lab and say, "Oh, no, you got to send this in, the Friday before, so it can stabilize the temperatures and everything's right." And I'm like, "What are y'all talking about? This isn't the way we're using it in the real world." And you take off the ground, the temperature is 70 degrees. You go at the altitude, it might be 30 degrees. And there's a temperature difference from the top of the camera system to the bottom of the camera system. It's like, well, that's not the way that we're using it. And I always thought that was kind of a odd way to do it. But so today we're essentially, most of us have a, we call it a validation range. It's an area maybe a mile by 2 miles in size. Ours has about 40 control points, in it. And we're flying it at different altitudes, and we're testing it in the real world environment is what we're doing on that. So it's not in a lab. And so then we run through, the process, and we're validating both the geometry of, the camera system itself, and also, working with the coordinating the exterior orientation with the XYZ, positioning and the omega theta kappa exterior orientations.
So we've moved from lab calibration to field calibration. I agree with you in that nobody flies in a lab, nobody flies a project in a lab. So therefore, I don't know how valid that lab calibration necessarily was. But again, even in the drone world, we have a prior company I worked with, we have a validation field not too far from here, and it had 20 leveled through control points, so we know those control points are right on. Drones, of course, usually have off-the-shelf cameras. They're not, exactly stable. There's a lot of plastic in there. There's a lot of moving parts. Things move around. So when we would do a project, at least, maybe every other week, or when we were out training or whatever, we would put them over the validation site, and they would do calibration that way, so consistently keep it up to date. You guys do similar to that. I would assume you've got it somewhere near one of the airfields that you operate out of. You can quickly, hop up and grab that area, whether it's on your way out to a project or on your way back. And you can kind of use that to help validate things. So, when we talk about that, you were talking about in these calibration fields, you fly at different altitudes. So explain a little bit about that and why you're doing that as far as how you're validating your calibration.
We do, if we're doing a boresight, which is we're really, tying everything down, we will do two different altitudes just to have a variety, so we're not in a narrow focus. And what that does too is it puts the whole, control field in different parts of the camera system or the
Gotcha.
imagery. Can you do it with one altitude? Yeah, sure. We're doing it with two just as a extra little effort on that. Since we're talking about that, we do this on a regular basis because we got multiple flight crews, and you just don't know when that big size 10 foot, in that airplane hit something the wrong way, maybe just jostled the IMU or something. If it's not just exactly right, it's going to show up in your end results. It's just not going to be there, especially getting into direct geo-referencing. And another comment, you mentioned about, the type of camera sensors on some of the drones. Well, you get into, with our large format, we was always used to doing something for engineering design. It had to be right on the money on the positioning. Well, a lot of the stuff, we loosely call it GIS quality, but it's like, it's good enough for what we're trying to do. We're just trying to put things in perspective. We're not going to be building anything on it. We just want to know what's there. So again, that's another driver for, multiple different tools in that toolbox. You don't need to run a $1 million camera system, over a project where you just need to put some kind of relationship on where things are to one another.
So, you brought up a term that I want to just get clarification on. So, is there a difference between a calibration field and a boresight?
It can be the same field. The differences are, again, we're using the word calibration. I really like to use the word validation. And what we're doing is we're validating the geometric integrity of the camera system. Now, if you fly the site, you've got control points out the wazoo. You use these, some as control points, some as checkpoints, and you're doing AT, and then you do your checkpoints, and yes, this thing is geometrically a valid system. When you get into a boresight, now we're adding in the GPS, and I'm using GPS as a general term for any global navigation system on that. And the IMU, now we're getting into exterior orientations. The geometry is only interior orientations, and the IMU and GPS are exterior orientations. And so of course, you got the same data, and now you have an AT. Now you can compare that to what the raw data is from the IMU and the GPS, and you can make some adjustments and have offsets, which you apply in the software so that you can do a direct geo-referencing. It's reasonably close without ground control.
Right. So in that case, you're talking about correcting, for example, what the INS is reporting as lat long or XYZ and omega kappa phi versus where the software says it perhaps might be. And then you can do your lever arm adjustments from that
Correct.
so that the next time you fly that project, you've got the right information.
Right. And then, what we do on a fairly periodic basis, we'll fly at a range. We'll just simply do the process with the direct georeferencing. And if it fits, we have a reasonable confidence level that what we're doing is we're putting out good data. It's a comfort level. Clearly, if you're putting out bad data, the customer hopefully will tell you right away. But what we found sometimes is, well, we fly the job, we send it to our customer. It might sit in their queue for a month.
All the
And
while
then
you're
if there's
flying.
a pro yeah, and then they find a problem. Well, they find a problem after the leaves came out or after the ground conditions changed, and you can't do it. So that's not a good thing. Nobody's happy on that one.
Well, and like I said, then maybe you didn't make adjustments, and who knows how many other projects you've flown in that time that might cause the same issue. So the
Well, one
fact,
other,
go ahead.
yeah, one other thing, to talk about that is, we had to become somewhat of an expert on this. Because in the earlier days, we'd get a complaint, hey, this data's not matching. And for us at the time, well, it was just a black box. We're just giving you the data that came out of the black box, and we didn't have problem-solving capabilities. But as we learn over time, well, maybe somebody used a different geoid.
Oh yeah. Why is my
Maybe,
data off 28 feet?
yeah, why is my data off? Well, there's so many different factors involved on this, and everything has to be exactly right with the project or problem, or it fails. So, and we've had that, where, the client, had a surveyor, and the surveyor used, the wrong geoid, and now nothing matches, and now you get into the finger pointing, and so we had to get the software. Your software is something that we use to understand, is our data truly good or is there a problem?
And to bring up the geoid one's easy because especially in the drone world that one comes up a lot when someone's processing data and they're like, well, how come my data is off 28 feet? And then in the when I look at compare it to control or whatever, what and the first thing you say, well, is it consistent? Is it consistent? Is it 28 feet here, 28.01 here, 28.02 here, on down the line? If it's consistent, then it's a geoid problem probably, and all you have to do is make that adjustment. And I would assume it's the same even when you're doing your bore site and you see that shift is consistent. Consistent's a good thing.
Right.
It's when it's
Right.
all over the
Exactly.
place and you got
Exactly.
other problems.
Yeah. That's right. That's right.
Fortunately we do have, like you said, we do now have the software at our hands that where we can figure this stuff out, because like you said, in the beginning, it might have been a black box, and it may have come down to a discussion of whether or not the surveyor was confident in his work and you were confident in yours, and like you say, finger pointing everywhere. And now I think before it ever leaves the door, we can have a pretty good idea of, everything's consistent, everything's right.
Right. Yeah. So, the reality of where we're at now is, we're confident in what we're putting out is good data. So the first step is just simply make sure we're all on apples and apples and oranges, with our datum, geoid, all these other, factors that enter into it.
So another thing you've got going on, and you mentioned that, is now you've got LiDAR sensors and imaging sensors capturing data, maybe at the same time, maybe not, who knows, but you've got two different systems out there collecting information, which have their own LiDAR
Correct.
calibrations different
Correct.
than, which creates challenges unto itself. But we can probably agree that LiDAR data of the ground is pretty darn good, especially as we talk about,
Yeah.
with vegetation and other things like that. So at least it's almost like you've got a check with you because If the LiDAR data is of quality and your photogrammetric solution matches that, you're probably right on.
Everything is consistent and it matches, within itself. And then, if there's any issues, it's simply somewhere even in the control points. Again, maybe slightly different datum, slightly different geoid, that can cause some problems on that. But that being said, from time to time, the system doesn't work correctly. We get our data in and it's just not working. We can't find it out, then we simply have to go out and redo it.
I mean, that certainly happens sometimes. So when you're collecting out in this validation field, is there a specific way you want to collect data to ensure that you're going to get a good result? Or is it's really more related to the quality of control and the spread out of control within that field?
The only thing that we do that would fit into what you're saying is we make sure we have opposing flight lines. So in other words, each flight line that's adjacent is flown in a different direction. So in other words, they're not all flown in the same direction.
And then that would make sense because then you're looking at the camera parameters from different directions as you go down it. So
Taking out any bias somewhere along the way. More
okay.
important with the LiDAR than it is for the cameras.
Interesting. Yeah. So the calibration itself, performing the or validation, we'll call it. I think you had mentioned to me in the past that at least at this point in time, you're using Correlator 3D more for that than actual processing of data.
Correct. And the reason for that is we're not advertising ourselves as a mapper. Somebody is going out and doing, large orthophoto jobs. We have the tools to do that. We don't have the capacity to do that, nor do we want to do that. That's not our niche.
My comment to that is that that's one thing that people may not understand is that the software that we have, Correlator 3D, does that type of work as well. It does AT and it does quick validation of data. So you may just say when you hit the ground, hey, I want to make sure I got complete coverage here. I can run a script and I can see that I got complete coverage. I'm not in the mapping business. That's what my customers do. And they may do it with different software. They may do it with, stereo setups and things like that.
That's exactly right.
I mean, that's still a very viable way to do mapping. And if you're going to do work that involves, say, like curb and gutter, that's the way to do it. Image-based processing is probably not going to get you that result. LiDAR will, especially in, low altitude and mobile capacity, but not necessarily from high altitude. You guys are aerial photographers. You're data collectors, not necessarily data processors. So
Correct.
everybody has their own place in the world, just like you're probably not a bunch of surveyors. So
Right.
that's the nice thing about our profession is that although we overlap in a lot of things and although we have to understand what the other side is doing, it doesn't mean we need to do it all. We don't have to become experts in all of that.
That's right. It was several years ago, a little bit before, we got into the digital world. In the old days, I knew everything about every process in my company. Then, as our technology started changing and getting to be diverse and more in depth, I realized that I could not keep up with everything. It was impossible. So now we've become specialists in different areas. Now we have people that, they process the imagery and others they process the LiDAR stuff. And I'm doing contract. We all have our little specialties now.
And this is not a new thing because back in the day there were aerial photographers who just captured the imagery and the film went off to process somewhere else because they
That's
didn't
correct.
necessarily have that
That's
equipment.
right.
Or if you go farther back in the days of glass plates, who had the ability to process out glass plates? Not a lot of people.
No, you're going way back now, Eric.
All right, I'm just reminiscing on how old I am.
Yeah, well, no matter what you're saying, I'm older.
Yes, well, you might have me about a little bit. The last thing that I wanted to talk about before, I let you go and we go into a little bit of the demo is we talk about monitoring sensor performance over time. To the layman, why do we want to do that?
Well, hopefully the camera systems are stable internally and you don't run into issues there. But if there's a physical jarring of that instrument, the geometry would need to be checked. What we're doing mostly is checking and validating the IMU and GPS.
Okay.
The GPS really isn't much of a monitoring thing, but if we're talking about different aircraft systems, say we move a system from aircraft A to aircraft B, it's going to have a different lever arm. Well, we're going to have to check that just to make sure. But then you have this potential that your IMU moved. I mean, an IMU, they're precise enough that they can be jarred and moved out of place, and it's not visible
Yeah.
to us as human beings. It can only be measured.
That goes to what we were talking about, the quality of these measurement systems. I mean, they're not in inches, they're not even in millimeters. They're tighter than that, you
Yeah,
know.
most everything's measured in microns, which is a thousandth of a millimeter. Well, a millimeter is just a little teeny tiny little thing. We'll take that, divide it by 1,000, and there you are.
Any IMU is giving you roll, pitch, and yaw and other things. So now you got degrees to deal with and
Yeah, it's very small,
very small.
very small angles.
In our software and in others, you can do that through the AT process and monitor your camera over time. Really, what you're looking for is big changes, but little changes you can work with, and you can go with a new calibration.
Right, you can do that with a, I would call that a new bore sight, if it's just micro. So what we're doing, our bore sights in the past have been to, within a pixel, on our imagery. And, once you zoom in, you can see that, hey, these aren't matching by a pixel. It's like, oh, okay, well, that's good enough, or, maybe you might want to tweak that a little bit more. But that's getting to be pretty fine.
We're talking about trying to produce the highest quality deliverable for the customer that we can. So, that's definitely the reason that you want to monitor these things over time. And especially, you may be doing something for them over time where you're monitoring a quarry or anything like that, and you want to make sure that the results they're getting are the same.
Correct, especially if we're doing a project where there's change detection involved on that, and even though on those projects, even though there might be a new datum set coming out, we stick with the same datum set that we started with, just keep everything the same.
A lot of times they might have their own global site set up, so they're not actually on, a datum that we would use or something like that. So
And of course, a lot of state projects, several states have gone to a countywide datum as opposed to a state plane coordinate system. So it's taken a while. Some of the softwares are have took them a while to start adding that in, their system. So we had to do it manually, back in the beginning. So now when you have projects that cross over multiple counties, well, are you going to stick with a county-based system, or are you going to go to state plane? There's lots of factors to be involved on that.
Yeah, and being somebody who operates nationally, you've got to be aware of that everywhere you're at.
Yep. We haven't gotten into, the different datum systems in Africa or, the subcontinent. We're not doing projects there, but there are some of our larger customers that do that. We're just not there collecting that data.
Very good, very good. Well, I want to thank you for joining us. We appreciate having you as a client. I appreciate having you as a peer. Although we only get to see each other, every once in a while at conferences and so forth, always good to, have someone to bounce ideas off of. And I know I call you every once in a while and we talk about what we're doing in the profession. And any last words?
You talked about using multiple systems. We last few years we've been doing projects that involve nighttime imaging.
Interesting.
So now we're getting into, using a LiDAR system and kind of using that as control, because you don't have the other visible things to add, even to do as a tie point if you are trying to do it photogrammetrically. It almost has to be on a direct georeferencing.
Yes.
methodology, and we can use LiDAR more as the control, for that.
So in it,
So there's
in a situation like that, what dictates the altitude? Is the altitude dictated by the footprint of the camera or by the optimum swath width of the LiDAR unit?
LiDAR takes precedence.
Okay.
Typically, the LiDAR swath width is more narrow than the swath width of an optical system.
Okay. Okay.
So, and that works out, especially with medium formats. You might have a 30% side lap, with your LiDAR swaths, but that translates tend to maybe a 60% side lap on the camera systems.
Interesting.
So you have more imagery. And I know you mentioned that the processing the same, it was medium format or large format, to a point, that's correct. You end up with more imagery, but if you're going to end up with an ortho photo, you're always using the sweet spot,
Yes.
of the center of the imagery. That way. So you end up with a higher quality and less lean over too if you have buildings in there.
Sure. Interesting. Night imagery. Pretty cool.
Yeah, we're the only ones that's doing that as far as I know.
Well, very good. And once again, Ken, we appreciate your time. For the podcast listener, this podcast was developed from a webinar. That webinar does have a visual component to it. If you would like to view the webinar, you can do that at www.simactive.com. It's in our knowledge base. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe through your favorite podcast subscription service. Also, if you enjoyed the podcast, please share on social media. Until next time, thank you.